Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am here today with Carmen Chavez, who is in, I believe, is department chair. Condolences to her on that. Of the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And we're here today to talk about her brand new book, actually from last year, The Borders of AIDS, Race, Quarantine, and Resistance. Carmen's got a bunch of work out over the last 10 years or so. 2013's Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities, which I know is very, very well received. Palestine on the Air from 2019, which comes out of Karma's radio hosting out of WORT FM in Madison. A bunch of edited volumes. There's a whole lot going on here, and it's a really fantastic scholar, and it's a real. Real honor to be able to speak to Carmen today. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Yeah, so your book has so much to offer, I think, readers today. And that's one reason why I wanted to talk about it. Before I go into questions, can you just sort of explain the basics of the book for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, so The Borders of AIDS is, you know, it's a book that was like, all books, I guess, a long time in the development of it. It was originally going to be a book about AIDS activism and immigration. And then as I was doing the research for it, I sort of realized that maybe there wasn't enough material that I could locate that could hold a whole book. So as I was engaging in the research, I started to see this rhetoric of quarantine coming up all the time about HIV and AIDS. And I'm not a historian, I'm a rhetoric scholar. And so, I guess I hadn't realized this. And then I started to see it basically proliferate. And so the book shifted a bit to think about initially how and why something like quarantine, which would do no good with something like HIV and AIDS, which is not spread communicably, how it came to sort of dominate the public sphere in the early days of AIDS in the United States, and then how that was taken up against particular populations. And so in the cases I'm looking at specifically, you know, the primary targets, even though it was white gay men who were most up in arms about being impacted by quarantine, it was really Black folks, whether that was Haitians or Black sex workers who were targeted in the United States. And then I argue that that same kind of logic of quarantine ends up manifesting in a massive way as immigration policy in the U.S. So I'm trying to tell this kind of story. I'm trying to locate that move in immigration policy with regard to disease as a much deeper logic in the U.S., what I call an alienizing logic that is, I say, fundamental to the U.S., which is not really an earth-shattering idea, but I feel like it was a helpful analytic for me. And then the last part of the book does take up activism and how people were responding to and trying to challenge the U.S. government in this regard.
And so I want to build on a lot of what you have said. And, you know, it's funny, you're earlier in your book, you're like, well, you know, I'm not a historian, and I'm going to summarize this gigantic sort of history of the discourse on quarantine. And you could tell you were kind of uncomfortable with it. But as a historian, I was like, oh, this totally works. Like, I appreciated that. So could you kind of provide a little bit of that for our listeners?
Yeah. And thank you for saying that. So I wanted to go back and sort of to see how disease was talked about, how quarantine was imagined in the U.S. And if you start looking back at that history, you realize very quickly that whenever quarantines were going to be, you know, issued, whenever laws were going to be made about quarantine, you could almost guarantee that immigrants were in some way at the center of that. And then relatedly, different communities of color and, of course, poor folks. And so, you know, even things like, you know, Hansen's disease, which used to be known as leprosy, right? Quarantine folks with Hansen's disease. But if you were a rich white person, you were never actually going to be put in one of these hospitals that housed folks. They were largely populated by poor folks of color, immigrants, and all sorts of diseases throughout U.S. history were like this. And of course, there's also thinking about the kind of anti-blackness of public health history in the United States informs this as well. And you know, really the first quarantines in the United States were for soon to be enslaved Africans, right? And so it's that history of quarantine is deeply embedded in the way that we view those we marginalize in society.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that we see that, going from, China, the politics around Chinese exclusion into, what was happening in places like Ellis Island to, obviously more recently as well. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about that at the end. But so our listeners, many of them have some remembrance of, I think, some of the quarantine stuff in the 80s, but many don't. And, could you kind of remind everybody about just sort of what happened within the 80s with the rise of HIV AIDS and the way that the federal government responded through these quarantines?
Yeah, I mean, it's, of course, the Reagan era, right? And so, and likely AIDS had been around for a long time before it gets officially designated in 1981. Nevertheless, it gets designated in 1981. And so, Reagan is president, and Reagan actually doesn't publicly mention AIDS in a speech until 1987. But he and his advisors were discussing it behind the scenes. And of course, at state and local levels, people were discussing it too. And one of the first indications on record of someone kind of demanding quarantine for people with AIDS is our good friend, the late Reverend Jerry Falwell, who was leader of the Moral Majority. And, he starts making these arguments publicly, and then they're taken up by folks like Jesse Helms, William Dannemeyer, who do introduce federal legislation that never really goes anywhere. But a lot of state and local public health officials do take these somewhere. And so, and I should add, they're also, surprisingly to me, the fact of whether people living with AIDS should be quarantined was debated widely on the pages of law journals. It was a question that was asked by pollsters for prominent papers all the time. The state of California voted twice about whether people living with AIDS should be quarantined en masse. So it was a surprisingly prominent discourse at a whole host of levels.
And how was this sort of taken up by the states? Can you go a little more detail about that? I mean, did the states really have the wherewithal or the resources to actually do this?
The short answer to that is no, they really didn't. But most states already had some kind of quarantine law on the books from 19th, early 20th century. And they had kind of gone dormant, of course, but when HIV and AIDS came up as a big concern, a lot of lawmakers went back to take a look to see what they had at their disposal in terms of legal responses. And so what ends up happening in most states is they can't pass a whole quarantine bill that would quarantine everyone. But what they can do is target what they would call incorrigible or recalcitrant people living with HIV. And so in other words, people who were refusing to tell their partners that they had HIV, and actually people who are refusing just to stop having sex. But the people who end up being most impacted, of course, are those who rely on having sex for pay and couldn't necessarily stop. And so this is where you see in particular Black sex workers being targeted all across the country, and some of these laws that end up happening being built on their backs. The story that I don't tell, and that others like Trevor Hoppe and Stephen Thrasher have told, is on the one hand, you get a medical response, which is to quarantine these folks. But this is also the beginning of what we now call HIV criminalization, which also has disproportionately targeted Black folks and created a criminal penalty for not disclosing your status or, for having sex at all.
I mean, to go a little bit further on the issue of primarily Black sex workers, I mean, how did how did they, you know, how did this rhetoric target them explicitly, right? In other words, you know, they're being targeted even more than white sex workers through this process, right? So what's, you know, what can you give, I guess, a little bit more about the contours of sort of how they're really channeling this into it's a fairly narrow group of people who are already being, you know, oppressed or whatever in a number of different ways.
So the truth of the matter is there were probably lots of people that may have gotten wrapped up in some of these applications of quarantine law. But the only people who ended up being the subjects of media frenzies were Black sex workers. And I didn't know this going into the research. It was through doing the research that just kept coming up. And then I'd go and I'd find, if the race wasn't mentioned, I'd, you know, talk to another historian or talk to, try to find an image and realize they're Black. So the kind of most famous case of this is a guy in Texas who is named Fabian K. Bridges. And Bridges was just this kind of ordinary guy. He had kind of a job working for the city, Black dude in Houston. And then he gets sick with AIDS around probably maybe 1983, 84, 85. It's hard to tell when he's infected with HIV. But when he gets sick, he loses his job. And this had happened right around the same time that Houston had Employment Non-Discrimination Act for gay and lesbian folks at the time, that was up for vote and wasn't passed. And there was this media crew from Minnesota that was going to come down to learn about what happened after this, this employment non-discrimination thing happened. And turns out that wasn't very interesting, but there was all this kind of gossip about this Black guy who was a sex worker and had AIDS and was still having sex. And so basically this media crew starts following him. And, you know, he tries to flee them. He ends up going to Indiana for a while. He ends up going to Ohio for a while, and they kind of keep following him. And, you know, he's destitute. His family doesn't want anything to do with him. He's lost his job. He's got this disease that's made him a pariah. And so this news crew, actually, they're giving him food and shelter and things to keep doing what he's doing. Well, eventually, you know, he ends up back in Houston when he's really, really sick. He tells some doctors he's not going to stop having sex. He dies, is buried in a pauper's grave because there's no money. Well, what becomes of this is a documentary that ends up on Frontline. And it's this huge controversy because it sort of becomes everyone's worst nightmare of people living with AIDS at the time. And it's obviously national news. And it's on his back that the public health department in Houston, as well as in the state, actually make proposals for quarantine laws, quarantine provisions, because, you know, this is what we can expect if we don't, you know, control these people. It's a very, in my mind, it's a very tragic story. Bridges clearly had no idea that he was going to be exploited in the way that he was.
Sort of one more question along these lines. I mean, one of the terms that gets sort of bandied around a lot at this time is that these quarantines are just sort of, I believe the direct quote is common sense, that this is just common sense, you know, action. And could you expand on that a little bit and talk about the ways in which such draconian laws would be seen as common sense by, you know, a relatively sizable part of the American political establishment at this time?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising in some ways, and of course, not surprising at all. As you know, we're looking at another disease labeled as a gay disease with monkeypox, et cetera. But I think, you know, this emerges in a time of extreme homophobia and anti-Black racism. And so if the largest groups that are impacted are queer folks and Black folks, which was the case, in some ways, I think it makes sense in the racist imaginary of folks like the Reverend Jerry Falwell or Senator Jesse Helms, who were two of the biggest proponents, that you could pitch this sort of further isolating already isolated groups as common sense. Where I really get into this, though, is in talking about how the immigration ban gets passed. And so in 1987, the Senate ends up, well, the first time actually that the full Senate has a debate about AIDS is the debate that they have about whether to ban immigrants with AIDS. And eventually they change that to HIV positive immigrants. And, you know, the entire debate centers around this idea of common sense. I mean, Jesse Helms was notorious for making common sense appeals, whether it was about abortion or women's rights or, you know, anything to do with gays. But, you know, he really grounds his arguments in this idea that it's about what's best for the nation. And obviously what's best for the nation is not to have more sick people, implied more sick Black queer people, right? You know, that ban passed in the Senate 96-0. And so, you know, at the end of the day, everyone was more or less persuaded that this was the right thing to do, that it was in fact common sense.
Yeah. And then, you know, we've talked about sex workers, but of course, you know, what we're already getting at here is the impact on Haitians as well, the kind of racism that Haitians face. I mean, I think especially compared, you know, to their neighbors, the Cubans, you know, and scholars have explored the difference in policies between, you know, how the U.S. welcomes Cubans versus Haitians for a long time. But, you know, can you talk more about the specifics of anti-Haitian racism and the ways this sort of is used to reinforce that?
Yeah. So, you know, people our age would remember, but maybe younger folks won't remember that, you know, in 1982, the Centers for Disease Control designates four high risk groups for HIV, and they're colloquially called the 4-H group because it's homosexuals, hemophiliacs, heroin users or IV drug users, and Haitians. So Haitians are the only national group or you know, a group that's designated not for their behavior, but for who they are. And this happened because at the time, there were a number of cases among Haitians, both in the United States and in Haiti. And it was sort of inexplicable because to date, you know, AIDS was imagined as primarily a gay disease, that's how it was transmitted. And so most of the Haitians didn't report having had homosexual sex. It's hard to say whether that was true or not, but that was, you know, what was being reported. And so almost immediately upon their designation, I mean, you can look at what happened in New York or Miami, but, you know, Haitian businesses lost any clientele that wasn't also Haitian, including some that were. People lost their housing. People were absolutely discriminated against, even worse than they already were right off the bat. And the Haitians fought back. I mean, they held huge protests. They at one point shut down the Brooklyn Bridge because they were not allowed then to be able to donate blood. And of course that's imagined as this kind of, you know, American thing, that, you know, an indication of good citizenship. And so they were always implicated in this. And as time goes on, whether it's Africa or Haiti, you know, Haitians become one of the big scapegoats, assumed to not just be predisposition, but in fact to be the origin of AIDS. And this results in not just discrimination, but kind of the most extreme form of this is after the overthrow of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1991. And so the stage is already set, right, for Haitians to be treated badly when it comes to immigration policies, you intimated. But in 1991, as usual, there's a political coup. People are fleeing for the United States, as usual. The U.S. government is trying to intercept people in the sea and get them sent back. But there are a number who actually should qualify as political refugees. So those who do, who are HIV negative, are sent on, of course, very, very small numbers. But there's about 300 people who would otherwise qualify for political refuge, but are HIV positive, and there's a ban on HIV positive immigrants. Now, these are refugees. They shouldn't actually have been held to the standard of the law for immigrants, which was supposedly different, but it wasn't. So for almost 2 years, they're held in what were described as concentration camp style conditions on Guantanamo Bay. While the U.S. government figured out what to do with them, and while, you know, supporters agitated for them in the U.S. and why they you know, waged hunger strikes and resisted in all sorts of ways. But as they were there, in fact, as they were in the middle of a hunger strike, that's when the U.S. Senate finally codified the ban on HIV positive immigrants, which was in place until 2010.
So I think that, you know, this has been great and incredibly informative. I think probably for the rest of the podcast, though, we should move on and talk about some of the activism behind it and some of the really interesting things that you uncovered. And I think one of them is, well, I guess, could you talk more about how you were able to sort of trace activism making a difference on the ground around these issues over the time period of your study?
Yeah, so one of the things I focus on is a lot of the agitation surrounding the international AIDS conferences. And so even to this day, the international AIDS conferences are a site of exchange of information, and they bring people from all over the world together to share information, to share treatment strategies, to really try to remedy the problem. And in the early days of the International AIDS Conference, it was just scientists. There'd be some public health officials, you know, but there weren't any sociologists or there weren't any people living with AIDS who were really a part of the conversation. But early on, I mean, we know the history of AIDS activists. They were always, you know, very insistent on having a seat at the table, and they insisted on that here too. And eventually they were able to get a seat at the table. Well, as with most big conferences, of course, they schedule these out, you know, a few years in advance. And so the 1990 conference was supposed to be in San Francisco. It's thought to be a great place. They had this really unique kind of community approach to treatment that was more inclusive than in some other cities, had some good results. So it seemed like a great place, but there was a ban on people migrating to or from the United States if you were HIV positive. And at the time, this also included travelers. So first of all, it's like the Red Cross who in the UK that learns this. And so a lot of these nonprofit organizations threaten to boycott the conference. Well, activists and groups like ACT UP catch wind of this, and they decide it's a great opportunity to really agitate. And so they use the conference as an occasion to draw attention to the plight of HIV positive immigrants and the bill. And, you know, they had some good success in the sense that, you know, this did pressure the Bush administration to say that they were going to overturn the ban. That doesn't end up happening because the right really came back with a lot of pressure in return, and the Bush administration cowed to it. But, you know, over the course really of 3 years, they made a change in the way people thought about the issue. And, you know, they got the conference in 1992, which was supposed to be held in Boston, they actually got that moved to Amsterdam because it couldn't happen with the threat of boycott.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that these activists are able to do, and this is relevant today in the era of climate change and, you know, the kind of issues around COVID, is sort of drag these scientists into politics often unwillingly. Could you talk about both how they did that and why that was so important to sort of, you know, helping them to, you know, move away from this ban and have a greater acceptance of you know, HIV AIDS positive people?
You know, it's hard to overemphasize the significance of AIDS activists in ensuring that ordinary people who live with conditions actually can get a seat at the table of scientists and physicians making decisions about their lives. In any place that happens today, you have AIDS activists to thank for this. And so in the specific case of thinking about the immigration ban, you know, early on, the scientists and doctors that were leading the International AIDS Society, you know, they weren't really thinking much about this. They were worried about the boycott, but they figured they could kind of work it out. When activists got involved, they made it very clear that they weren't going to be able to come up with a sort of behind the scenes compromise, that they were going to have to address it directly. And so you have some of these really prominent scientists, names that you'll still recognize, like Anthony Fauci, who were giving speeches which otherwise would have been dry scientific addresses at these conferences. And instead, they're forced to name the politics of the situation. They're forced to implicate themselves. And I mean, I think that was quite significant.
Yeah. I mean, I teach a course here at University of Rhode Island on, you know, it's called Protest and Resistance in America, that's sort of intended to, kind of train young people about, you know, how change happens and give them some hope in an era where they often don't have it. And I find that over the years, I turn more and more to really looking at these AIDS activists as perhaps the most important group in the last, 40 years or 50 years to provide lessons for contemporary activists going forward. I'm wondering, since you were talking about that, sort of how you sort of see these AIDS activists as kind of framing the possibilities of activism in the present.
I could not agree more with your assessment of their significance. I 100% agree. And I think one of the big things, I mean, first of all, I'll say, for folks who are interested in this, reading Sarah Schulman's tome, Let the Record Show, it's worthwhile because it's really meant to be a handbook for how we take the lessons of ACT UP New York for today. And I think it's totally relevant. But what did, that look like in practice? I mean, they refused to be silent. They refused to compromise. They used humiliation as currency. They used visibility as currency. They used outrageousness as currency. Excuse me. And what a lot of people also don't realize, unless they're, in queer theory or study these kinds of histories, is that the very notion of queerness and the kind of out and proud politics of that, that extends directly from AIDS activists who were thrown out of the closet in many ways, and they had to embrace it because it was a matter of life and death, and they fought like it was a matter of life and death, which is not always, I think, what you see in contemporary activist politics.
We could go on a huge tangent about this, but I do agree, and I think that there is a kind of a, there's a kind of a tension in, I think, a lot of contemporary politics between, to be very superficial about it, between people who sort of prioritize electoral politics over all other politics as the only way to make change, and those who, kind of eschew that and claim in a sort of a protest politics, but then even there maybe don't really engage in the same kind of life and death, direct action, aggressive activism that is, that was kind of the hallmark of that time. I don't know if that's something you agree with or disagree with, or what your thoughts are on that kind of very vague sort of formulation.
Well, I think, like, if you take ACT UP in particular, I think one of the big lessons of ACT UP was anything goes, right? And so if you wanted to focus on electoral politics, if you wanted to get into the mayor's office to have a conversation with the mayor, do it, go for it. Nobody's going to stop you. But if you wanted to wrap Senator Jesse Helms' house in a giant condom, you could do that too, right? And so it was sort of a winner's take all approach that was so far less invested in the kind of, the way that, you're either a radical or you're a liberal kind of thing that I really see characterizing a lot of our politics today.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's really, really insightful. And, I know you're busy and we should let you go. So I want to close on kind of a big question, which is that, since you referenced COVID very briefly in the book, but, obviously, I'm sure when you were finishing the book, COVID was just becoming a thing, knowing how publication timelines work. So, in the sort of contemporary politics of, say, the last 5 years, we're seeing COVID, right, which had its own sort of discussions of quarantine and things of this nature. The Trump immigration ban, first of all, the Muslim ban, and then, the what was going on the border, which Biden is not really been much better on. Mm-hmm. And then you have the overturning of Roe and the kind of debates around what is appropriate protest over this, right? And so, you know, chasing Kavanaugh, you know, to his you know, chain steakhouse is seen as like way out of bounds for a lot of people. And I think that, you know, your book that kind of touches on, you know, some of these issues more directly than others seems to me to have a lot to potentially say to the kind of complexities of contemporary politics. So I guess I'm wondering, that's a long preface to say, what do you think that this story and your book can offer to, you know, contemporary political people on how to sort of conceptualize change, figure out how to resist and sort of push back against the kind of, you know, racist and homophobic politics that were such a big part of the time in the 80s, but really are very much still around today?
Yeah. One of the things I hope that the book does is that it shows different levels of resistance throughout it. And so, for example, you know, in the chapter that really focuses on like the ways that Black sex workers were targeted, I found, you know, every direct quotation I could find from these folks where they were asserting their own agency, I tried to put them into the book. And the same thing with the Haitians who were detained at Guantanamo. Any of their words, any of the ways that I could grasp their resistance, even though it wasn't generally what the media took, I found it and I put it in the book because I wanted to go from there, those most minor acts of resistance, doing with what you have, to these more grand acts of act up, the in-your-face kinds of politics. And I think I return to that. I think we have to embrace more of an anything goes type of approach. I know, you know, a lot of my liberal friends like really hate Antifa and the possibility of, you know, taking a gun somewhere. I'm not advocating violence, but what I am saying is it takes a lot of different approaches to get something done. And we live in a time right now where almost all of what we consider activism is channeled into the nonprofit industrial complex. And that means that all that work is dictated by a few wealthy philanthropists. And we need a lot more renegade activism. We need a lot more activism of independent people that is not connected to large organizations, that's not beholden to rich people's money. And that's really what you saw with ACT UP. That's what you saw with the Haitians when they were detained. And I remain to think that that's the way forward.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, I think that multiplicities of tactics is critical. And I think so much is, you know, we do seem, in my view, very constrained by sort of whether it's certain stories from the past around nonviolence, whether it's kind of liberal pieties, or whether it's, you know, as you talk about it, you know, this philanthropist industrial complex. You know, given the crisis we face now, we need a lot. I agree that we need a lot more direct action in ways that I can maybe think of, but a lot of things that I'm not going to think of as well. You know, we need the panoply of all forms right now. So, you know, so again, I want to thank you very much for your book and for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah. So we've been here today with Karma Chavez, and I highly recommend her 2021 book, The Borders of AIDS, and it's published by the University of Washington Press, and it is a fantastic read that will do a lot for you. So we'll be back soon with another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Thank you all very much.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,